Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
Program complete. Enter when ready.
The curtain of night is drawn back. The telescopes are trained. The domes are open. The audience is set. Now, step into the event horizon.
You're live in 5, 4, 3.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the event horizon here on Astronomy.fm Radio. It is another Friday evening, for us anyways. And this one just happens to be May the 19th, 2017, 9 o'clock, well, a minute past 9 o'clock in the evening for us on Friday night on the eastern portion of North America. Yeah, my clock is just chiming the hour right now. Universal time, it would be 1 o'clock in the morning, Saturday morning, May the 20th, 2017. So you've got us live for the next hour. My name is Marty Coons with my co-host.
Good evening, everyone. It's me, Nicky Vets, KC2VWR, or 2Echo Zero, Lima Uniform November.
And of course, this is the time to come into the astronomy.fm chat room, which you can go to the homepage and see where it says chat. Click on that, or just type in astronomy.fm/chat. Either way, it will get you to the login page. Type in a name, any name you want to, be polite, and hit login, and you'll be here in our chat room, where you can ask us questions, because we try to read it on the air as we go along as best we can, and we'll try to answer any of your astronomy questions, sci-fi questions. We'll get a little bit off, you know, off theme a little bit.
But that's the event horizon, Marty. That's the whole point of the show.
If this was
the old style event horizon, people would be in chat. They will say something. And our dear friend Mr. Narlock would be going for it, wouldn't he? Let's face it. That's the old style event horizon. Well, full venomous throttle.
See, we're like more like a real event horizon, because we kind of like give you virtual information that sometimes it appears on the other side of the event horizon. Sometimes it's on this side of the event horizon. Well, and basically, it cancels each other out.
So does that mean you're the electron to my positron?
There you go.
Now, let's not get too chummy though. Before we go any further, let's have a PSA time, folks. Public service announcement. Sorry, now, our radio boffin Rob is going to be doing some maintenance on AFM tomorrow and Sunday. So he has said to us he will not try to interrupt the station, but he's not sure what time, and he'll also be working on other things. Now, if there is an interruption, it may mean for a few hours. You may not have your beloved astronomy.fm, but it's all in the best possible taste. That's and, of course, we want to thank one of our really great friends of the show. Take a bow, my friend. You know who you are, and I can see you've got a smirk on your face already from the emoji that's in the chat room. Yes, we really do appreciate you. You are one of our regular donators, so thank you, Glenn.
No saying it's going to be off, but just might be one of those glitch types of things, like, oh, that button did something else type of things.
Yeah,
should be okay, but I might actually get my email working again, so we'll see how much time Rob has and if he actually finds out it's an easy fix.
Mine has been working all the time, no problems. Now, in the chat room tonight, there's myself, Sky Guide Nick, Sky Guide Marty, of course, Glenn, Crowtown Skies, Cassie, Startomb, and Norge. Welcome to the show, guys. As I say, you the people in our chat room, you make the show what it is. Okay? So come on in, ask us questions. If we can't tell you this week, we'll make a point of telling you next week. Now, I found a story that most people have slipped up on and not found. In fact, it was posted in the engineer.co.uk website. And it's about a possible new space station from NASA.
Okay.
So, put the link into the chat room. They have six aerospace companies working on ground-based prototypes for a deep space gateway. Where's this going to be, you ask? It's going to be in lunar orbit, actually. What is its main function? Well, they're talking about Mars. They're talking about going to asteroids. And you know what? They need somewhere to test the gear. They need somewhere to put astronauts together for long periods of time. ISS is just not big enough. You've got regular crews going up and down all the time, and it can only hold a certain size team. So what are they going to do? They're going to build a brand new space station. One of the companies working on this is Boeing, and there's a few others who have got their fingers in the pie. So looking at the cutaway diagram, they're even going to have a Bigelow B330 inflatable module. So the six companies is Bigelow, it's Boeing, Sierra Nevada. They are rapidly becoming a space industry veteran, working with NASA to develop Dream Chaser. Orbital ATK is basing its concept on features of the Cygnus module. And so basically, this is going to be an interesting thing. Ioxen, they're teaming with space hardware specialist Nanorax, which has worked on ISS projects, along with Space Systems Loral. And ULA are going to be in the mix too. They're looking at doing a Skylab job, converting ULA Centaur rocket upper stages into habitat module. Well, you know what? That's what we did with Skylab. We used Saturn V and Saturn 1B module parts to build a space station. Brilliant way to do it, because you've already done all the really hard work of getting that stage into space. And now all you got to do is, once all the fuel is emptied, you turn it into a habitat. You have it as either as an accommodation module, a scientific work area, and you have a space. Okay, it's a space station on the cheap. We knew that with Skylab. But you know what? It did so much work. And, of course, came out of that was the Apollo-Soyuz link up in space, which, interestingly, helped us work towards the ISS, because it tested equipment to link two totally dissimilar spacecraft, a Soyuz and an Apollo command module, into one orbiting craft. So what's going to get there? How are they going to get there? They're talking about using SLS. They're talking about Orion. It will probably be a very big test for Dream Chaser, because that would be a perfect use for a crewed version to be a lifeboat. So if something catastrophic happened, instead of just waiting for maybe another Orion to be sent up to collect them and take them home, they would have an onboard lifeboat. And, of course, the Bigelow expandable activity module, it is already part way through its two-year trial on the ISS. So the actual things we have here really do open up. Forget about high Earth orbit. We're actually going back to lunar orbit. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a halfway home for astronauts. We're going to have a possible hub to go back to the moon and perhaps set up a lunar base. The European Space Agency recently has been experimenting with making bricks from a synthetic lunar dust. Now, I'm going to pop a link into chat. Just wait until a bit later to watch it, otherwise you'll miss the rest of the show. But it is certainly interesting to watch. And basically, all they're doing, they're just using sunlight and moon dust. How are they doing? How are they building these things on Earth? Very simple. The Germans have in their possession the equivalent of 470 suns. It's an artificial light source, but they're using it in a way to produce these bricks. They're basically setting up a way to produce building blocks, and they're literally going to do on Earth what will then be done on the moon. So I'll put that into chat as well.
Good idea to build basically a space station around the moon before heading to the moon. It's just basically you can do it kind of remotely, and if you get the stuff to kind of hook together a little bit. And yeah, I said you want to start building a moon base. Well, start with a a good waypoint in orbit around the moon, so you can bring a, you know, equipment to the station and then start working on bringing stuff down. And then that space station could also hold an emergency lander.
Mm-hmm.
LEM basically lands on the moon and can bring people back. So good. And it orbits around the moon, so you can do far side missions and stuff like that too without having to worry about...
Well, yeah, because basically what will happen is the biggest issue with Apollo using a far side landing site was communications with Earth.
Yep, and radiation.
And radiation. But the whole issue was, for a long time, if you had a mission to the far side of the moon, the LEM would not be able to communicate unless there was a satellite relay in place.
Right.
Now, the good thing is the habitat could provide a satellite radio link to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so it simply takes in a low power signal, boosts it, and sends it on to NASA, to Roscos, to ESA, to whoever. And that way they are in constant contact at all times with the mission.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to admit, I think it would be very, very good to have a far side manned mission. We've only been to a handful of sites which are relatively close together anyway. And there are places we need to go back to, Frau Maro being one, Hadley. So being able to eventually say, right, we can safely send a team to the other side of the moon to explore, to actually look at the crater impacts, and have that nice radio safety factor.
Because It would also require more another satellite system to go with it, though, because that space station would go on the far side of the moon and not be able to communicate with the Earth. Also,
well, no, it can be at a point where it can see the far side relatively into the far side and into the near side. It doesn't have to be on the far side. It can be at a point where it's equidistant from both limbs of the moon and able to see both sides and still talk to the Earth. It doesn't have to be totally on the far side.
How could it do that?
Well, for instance...
in orbit.
Well, it's they're not saying if it's going to be a geostationary or if it's actually just going to orbit around the moon at a set pace. They haven't decided that yet. But the thing is, if you were to put it in, say, for a mission to the far side, they were to move it to a point where it could see the Earth and still communicate with the far side, it would make the opportunities to visit the far side much easier. And it has always been the problem with such a mission, is contacting Earth and being in communications. And being at a high enough altitude, I would have thought that would be perfect.
I'd have to check on that one, because you could do like a lunar stationary type of orbit, but it'd be pretty far away from the moon because the gravity's so weak. You want to be like in a equatorial orbit, which would bring it around the far side, which would put it, you know, on the back side of the moon and not be in communication with the Earth at half of its orbit. If you did a polar orbit, you would still have a hard time getting to the, you know, the outer portions of its orbit, like the 90 degree point of its orbit. So, like, for instance, if it's equatorial orbit, you have a hard time getting right to the poles. Well, if you put it over the poles, then you know that's constantly facing the Earth, you'd still have a hard time getting to the sort of the equatorial poles of the moon that way.
The equatorial belt.
Yeah, well, the 90 degree points of the equatorial region of the moon.
But as I say, there's still a lot of talk about what exactly this space station is going to be capable of. Mm-hmm. It's obviously going to need to have thrusters in order to move if necessary, or to stable or keep itself in one position. And as Glenn points out, it's good that we can now have a greater margin of safety for lunar missions, and we could also use it as a relay, a signal relay back to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And as I remember, when I think was it Apollo 8 went behind the moon for the first time,
mm-hmm.
everybody was like gripping their seats, particularly Mission Control.
Mm-hmm.
They were sitting there waiting for the command module to reemerge from the shadow
mm-hmm.
And come back into contact. And that was probably the most difficult part of that mission, was when the command module went round the far side and was out of contact. Mm-hmm. However, having an orbital habitat that could possibly be moved as required would take away a lot of the problems. It also means, of course, you have a place you can stage a rescue from. So if there was an incident on landing of the new LEM, then they would possibly have something. They would probably have a spare around they could use. They could send it to become the survival ferry back home.
Yep.
As I say, it doesn't hurt, as Glenn points out, so there's a plan. It doesn't hurt to have a good rescue plan there, and you would have that now for a far side mission. And, of course, the far side of the moon would be a really, really good place to put a radio telescope.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it probably means that depending on the size, depends how much fuel it needs for station keeping. But at the moment, they're talking about ground-based prototypes so they can make a decision who gets to do what and when and where. Mm-hmm. However, this is a positive step forward. It's, instead of being, oh, we're just going to go to Mars, forget the moon, we're saying, hang on a minute, we need to go to the moon. We need to test not only the equipment for Mars, but we need to have these guys and girls used to being there, being in space for the time it would take to go to Mars and come home. All right, maybe I think the first Mars mission manned we will do an Apollo 8 style mission. We will go there, we'll circle, and perhaps do photography, and then select a better landing site for the next mission, which could be the lander. Mm-hmm. However, that is probably going to be a good idea. I cannot second-guess NASA. And, yeah, there is a part of me that's saying, I really wish James Webb was here because he would be loving it. He would love the technology we have today. He would like the fact that we have a lot more safety margins in place. It's not just going to be a wag. I'm sure many of you know what I mean by a wag. And that way we can properly protect and look after our Martian voyagers, our future lunar colonists, so-called. But as I say, until we do something and we get the heck out of low Earth orbit, we're not doing anything really special in low Earth orbit. Yes, it's a great place to do microgravity science. I accept that. However, we're not doing what we should have done 10, 15, 20 years ago. We should have gone straight back to high Earth orbit. With the end of the shuttle, people dragged their feet. They didn't have a replacement for the shuttle ready. And now we are paying for it. SLS is going to be delayed another year. Why? Well, gee, big surprise. Some idiot dropped a LOX tank. So now we've got to wait another year for SLS. The word is Boeing can only make 2 SLS rockets a year. Come on, guys. We were turning Saturn V's out every few months. We had those birds lined up ready for the missions that are already set up. And the last of those rockets that got to be used were used for Skylab and for Soyuz Apollo. We got to get out of this thing about, oh, we only need 2 a year. We need 3, 4, or 5 a year, not just 2.
If you want to build a moon station, you're going to have a lot of heavy lift vehicles.
Exactly. And at the moment, with the greatest respect to ULA and Heavy Falcon when it comes into service, it's going to take an awful lot of launches to get the kit up there, to be assembled and then to be taken. It's still got to get to lunar orbit once it's been assembled. And I don't know if they're going to assemble it in lunar orbit or they'll do it in high Earth orbit for and either take it over in a few weeks or what. But we should have been flying SLS 5 years ago. But politics, money, all conspired, and of course, everybody had different ideas what they wanted NASA to do instead of just buckling down and getting out of low Earth orbit. We're paying for mismanagement of the space agency.
That would be interesting to find out how big a space station you could actually strap a rocket to and send to the moon. Now, that'd be something. It'll be funny if they built it in the shape of like the Enterprise.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine that one.
Just put a disc and, some pods and,
Yeah, that'd be hilarious. Gene Roddenberry.
Like, yeah, and just build a space station in that shape. You would definitely get a lot of public support for that one.
Oh, absolutely. But you're going to have people nitpicking over which Enterprise. Is it going to be the NX-1, the NCC-1701, the ACE, the B, C, or D?
It'd have to be generic because you don't want to violate copyright laws. You know, so.
I can't.
Just a general saucer with a couple of pods.
I think if NASA told Paramount that they were going to build a space station in the shape of the Starship Enterprise, I don't see Paramount saying very much, do you? Because then they'd be using it, they'd be beating their chest with their fist and making more Star Trek films and stuff, saying, hey, we've even put the USS Enterprise into orbit around the moon as a space station. What better could you get? In that case, why don't we nick the design for Earth Space Dock whilst we're at it?
Mm-hmm. You could do all kinds of space stations, a Babylon 5 space station, a bunch of stuff too.
Yeah. And hey, that's right, Glenn. Let's get a burger and a shake at Mars Mac. Let's do that. That would be something. Sitting in McDonald's on Mars, probably eating synthetic beef and having a milkshake. A synthetic milkshake too, I bet.
You probably do more of having a restaurant on Phobos or Deimos looking at Mars instead of on Mars. The view would be much better.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Unless, of course, it's near Mons Olympus and you're looking at the volcano or the Valley Marineris. There's a spot for a restaurant.
That's so big it goes around the curve of the planet, so you probably still would have a hard time seeing most of it.
So you send some drones down with cameras so people can just log in and see.
We could do that here. You could build a restaurant and put a big screen projection TV there, whatever, and show pictures of Mars from the MRO.
Yeah, that's a cool idea, Marty. That is a very cool idea. I'll send that one to Buzz.
Okay, you do that.
Come on, let's face it. He's the one guy who thinks we should have been there years ago.
I'll build my kitchen like that. How about that? A dining room. You just got to build your own dining room with like projection screen material all the way around and project stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Space stuff.
Yeah.
Good work.
You could have eclipses on show. You could voyage around Venus, around Mars, around Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe once the Europa Express probe has been there and brought back a nice set of videos, we could have that as the... In food movie.
Glenn is saying, not enough gravity would lose my shake. Not if you make it thick enough, Glenn. More ice cream, less milk, and you'd have no problem. You know, if you can take your milkshake and turn it upside down and not have it, you know, fall out of the cup here on the Earth, and no problem with a milkshake on Phobos or Deimos.
Well, Cassie's stealing your idea. Cassie, we want more pictures.
More than welcome. More than welcome to, yes. Build your kitchen into a space kitchen.
That'd be fun.
I remember going to Vegas like 20 years ago, something like that. And that's when they had one of the hotels, casinos. One of the casinos was a Star Trek themed casino. And that was pretty cool. I actually ate at Quark's restaurant. So everything was all kind of space station-y stuff, and the slots were all, you know, space station themed and stuff like that. I actually liked that. It didn't last for very long. Not enough geeks have enough money to do that regularly. But man, I just like that was like a perfect place for space.
You know where that's gone, don't you? You know where the Star Trek experience has now gone to, don't you?
No, where's it gone to?
Lake George, New York.
Is it really?
Yeah.
That whole theme of that casino?
Well, what it is, James Crowley, who did the Star Trek Phase 2, the New Voyages.
Okay.
He has completely rebuilt the original sets down to the authentic detail. He's had Margiel Barrett, he's had most of the Star Trek alumni there, and Eugene Roddenberry Jr. all come by saying how impressed with the accuracy of his sets. You could go on the bridge, and he has a huge plasma screen for the ship's viewing screen.
So is this like a restaurant, or what is it?
No, this is where he used to make Phase 2 Star Trek.
Oh, okay. He built a sound studio.
He built the original Star Trek sets. You can You can give somebody a medical exam in Dr. McCoy's office. Mm-hmm. You have engineering. You have the transporter room, officers' quarters. And you can actually sit in the original, one of the original center seats there in complete uniform and everything else. And everything, all the sound effects are authentic. And on what they used to do was sometimes they actually show Star Trek episodes on the main screen.
So is that still built, still there?
Still built, still there. Every year it opens, every summer.
Oh, really? Oh, it's a tourist attraction?
It's become a tourist attraction, yeah. Because Paramount decided that they didn't like all the fan-based stuff because it was so much better than what they were turning out.
Yeah.
They got uppity because, well, the sad story was there was a project, there was a group called Anaxar. They were doing the Klingon War, which introduced Garth of Wazir, and shows the Enterprise as we know her in space dock being completed. And they had the late Richard Hatch of Battlestar Galactica, the original. He was playing a Klingon warlord. And what they did was, and I think this is probably where they made the mistake, they ran a Kickstarter to fund everything.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, the problem was they made an awful lot of money from the Kickstarter, and after they finished the movie, there was still a lot left over. Mm-hmm. So Paramount used that as an excuse to try and shut down all the fan-based productions. So they served legal notices on the Phase 2 group up in upstate New York. They served notices on Vic Morgano's group in Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the longest episode you can make now is 15 minutes, and it can be a continuing story. It has to be something new every time.
I like some of those Phase 2.
Yeah, they were really good. They actually took the time to get everything right.
Mm-hmm.
They got the sound effects, the visual effects. They even lovingly recreated the Desilu. And is it CBS or NBC Peacock
mm-hmm.
color effect at the beginning of the stories. Mm. And they actually introduced going back a little bit, I know we're digressing. Originally, okay. After Star Trek initially went off the air after 3 years, the third season, mm-hmm. they decided to resurrect the project as Star Trek Phase 2. Now, I'm sure we all remember the new super slim nacelles in Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Mm-hmm. Squarish ones.
Yeah, the rectangular ones, the rake back ones. What James and his team did, they created a synthesis of original Enterprise and the new nacelles.
Mm-hmm.
So they had the motion picture nacelles on the original saucer and engineering hull of the Enterprise.
Okay.
I think they made two episodes, and I think they may have been making the second or third episode, which had Richard Hatch in it, ironically. They went back to I Have Touched the Sky and The World is Hollow story and picked it up after a few years. Now, the thing was, when they released the shots of the new nacelles being fitted and the Enterprise launching out of an asteroid space dock, people mm-hmm. were like, wow, that's not Star Trek. And some of the original production team that worked with Gene Roddenberry says, actually, yes, what they've done, we had some drawings of the Enterprise, so she was going to change and eventually become, they were going to bridge the gap between original Star Trek and the motion picture.
Mm-hmm.
They had made arrangement, they had got reputedly got most of the original cast back under contract to make Phase 2, as they were going to call it. So the drawings were there, the engineering sketches, and then the plug got pulled up on it. They said something else came down the pike, and they decided they didn't want Star Trek anymore. It was too old hat. So Phase 2 got pulled. Now, after about 1.5 seasons of Phase of the New Voyages, James and his team got saw the sketches, because Eugene showed them to him. And he says, we could do that. We could actually start changing the Enterprise into what she becomes in the motion picture.
Mm-hmm.
So they started doing that. And a lot of us were like, really, wow. They got the new guy in to play Kirk, who was even more like Bill Shatner at that particular point in time.
Mm-hmm.
He had the right color hair. It was light at the top. It was stringy and the spiky bits and everything else. This guy would look, I think it's Brian Goss. He looked the part. Now, I like the Vig Magama stories. They are really, really good. He brought back Apollo in two episodes. Kim Stinger as Uhura was perfect. No, didn't quite like his Spock. A little bit too much not Spock. The Spock they had up at Lake George was pretty good and fitted in nicely. But that's just personal. They also, mind you, having said that, Lake George team, they got Walter Koenig to come in and actually guest star an episode. Mm-hmm. They got George Takei as a guest star in an episode. And it was just absolutely brilliant.
Mm.
And I'm really sad because this is the series that had got so many people into aerospace because they wanted to build the Enterprise. They wanted to build the ships that would become the Enterprise. And I think finally, if we can get this deep space habitat off the ground, if we can get SLS trundling off the production lines at least two a month, then maybe we can actually get back on track. We can go to Mars. We can go to the asteroid belt. Yeah, I know a lot of companies saying we would love to mine it. Brilliant. Let's take all the foul, reeking industrial processes off the planet. Let's put them somewhere else. Let's put them in the asteroid belt so that they can consume the asteroid belt. In the meantime, we can have scientists at those places who can be doing hands-on geology or astrogeology and bringing back information as well. So, yes, a lot of the metal-rich asteroids will probably go and be used up by industry. Hopefully, the stuff will be used to build bigger and better spacecraft.
Can you find a link to that place in New York? So if anybody wants to go visit it, sure. Go ahead and look for that. And I will say that you are listening to The Event Horizon here on Astronomy.fm Radio. It is now 9:32 in the evening, Friday evening, for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America, May the 19th, by the way, 2017. Universal time would put it at 1:32 on May the 20th, Saturday morning, 2017. So we're still live. Another half hour of live programming, so stay tuned. And, of course, we've got more programming coming up after the Event Horizon, and then we'll repeat everything in four-hour blocks for the next 24 hours. So, but this is the best time right now to come on into the chat room. If you have any questions for us, astronomy questions, or we'll put links in the chat room, you can click on those links, do some further reading, and find out some more information if you want to do that, too. So come on over in the chat room, because right now we've got me and Nick, we've got Glenn, Proton Skies, Cassie, Starstorm, Norge, Black Projects, Evil Spock in our chat room right now. So if you've got an astronomy question for us, come on over and type them in and let us know. We'll answer your questions best we can. This is turning into kind of like sci-fi night, so let me kind of continue on a little bit. We'll just like doing that too. We'll get to a little bit of a
astronomy.
Real astronomy. Well, this is all astronomy, just real astronomy. Two shows that I noticed are coming up pretty soon. Star Trek Discovery, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Television show on CBS.
Coming up. Actually, here in the U.S., it's going to be on Netflix.
Is it on? Well, it's going to be both, I think, CBS and Netflix. Maybe I'll have to get Netflix. Because I can get, if I want to watch it on a computer, I got to pay for it. So I don't get broadcast TV because I'm in kind of a dead zone right here. Even though I'm in the middle of a city, I'm in a dead zone for communications, like radio and television and cell phones. Not good. Also, another one, Orville by Seth MacFarlane. And this one looks like a fun one. This one's going to be on Fox, I think. Looks hilarious. Basically, it's a kind of a spoof, a space spoof. So a lot of comedy, but all set like in a futuristic space traveling thing. And from the preview, the trailer I saw, it looks really funny. It looks like they're going to do a good job with it. So I'm looking forward to that one. And that one will be coming up pretty soon, too. So hopefully I'll be able to find where that's at and hopefully somehow get it for free without paying to watch commercials. I had a pet peeve about paying to watch commercials.
We'll okay, I found a link for Discovery, too.
Okay, did you find Orville one?
No, I haven't found Orville yet.
All right.
Yes, it is in Ticonderoga. And believe it or not, the actual fort itself starred in a Star Trek New Voyages episode. It was used for the Klingon homeworld.
Okay.
So that's in there. You said Orville? Okay.
Orville, yep. You can look up Seth MacFarlane, Fox, Orville, type all those into a search engine, and that should get you the show, which is going to be up. And then you'll be able to see the trailer. It's kind of all over the place.
Yeah, basically, it's like Galaxy Quest, isn't it?
Yeah, but I kind of don't like comparing something to another show. It's not Galaxy Quest, so I don't want to compare it to Galaxy Quest, even though there's some similarities about like space traveling spoof Star Trek-y-ish. So, yeah, I have a thing about not comparing one show to another show because it's not the other show. So don't compare it. Now, if we want to compare Star Trek Phase 2 to the originals, okay, do that. Because it's kind of the same thing, but I don't like to compare one type of show to another type of show when they're different. Even with their
There you go. There's a link in there to Seth MacFarlane's Orville trailer.
All right, and it looked pretty good. So this is kind of stuff that I like.
Random non-important fact. Did you know that the guy who created SpongeBob SquarePants was actually used to teach marine biology?
Okay.
Seriously, well, straight up.
I was going to say, by the way, yeah, Galaxy Quest was one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, I liked that. I thought that was hilarious. I like a lot of Tim Allen stuff.
What if I've still got that disc around?
I've got a copy of my computer.
I left it behind. I might have to go buy it. I would actually buy another copy of that because that's one of those kind of movies that I could watch like once a year, sort of over and over and over again. Let's do a little bit of astronomy. Looking at the SOHO website at the Sun, new sunspot. Last Wednesday, there was just one in active region 2656. Now there's one a little bit south of it that just formed within the past 2 days. So that means it would be a good one to keep an eye on, 2658. So they're both like single spot groups, if you want to call them that. One's only the size of the Earth and one's smaller than the Earth, so not very impressive. But one did just appear. So that means keep watching it. It might grow into something a little bit bigger. Looks like we got kind of a bright region on the edge of the sun, too. So for hydrogen alpha viewers, looks like something's starting to rotate into view. So you might get some good prominences on the eastern edge of the sun. And we've got a little bit of solar activity coming our way. Supposed to have it a little bit hotter and faster, but that's still kind of moderate. So 400... Solar wind speed at 432 kilometers per second, particle density 5.67 protons per cubic centimeter. That's kind of down there, but there is a bit of a coronal hole in the sun right now facing towards us, so we're kind of going to be getting a decent amount of particles hitting us, so it's coming within the next couple of days. Should have been here already, but not quite, so look forward for some more solar activity next few days.
Talking about things star-wise, Tabby Star, otherwise known as the most mysterious star in the galaxy, is dipping drastically in brightness. It's giving astronomers an opportunity to figure out what's been causing this star's weird behavior. Even the Kepler Space Telescope captured a series of random-seeming dips from a certain mysterious star. Everybody's baffled. Now, following the end of the main Kepler mission, the star went quiet. Now, at long last, it's began a steep decline in brightness. It's already 2% dimmer after a single night observation, and telescopes all over the world are at the ready. What do we know? Well, it's famously known as Tabby Star. It's a normal-looking F-class star in the field of the Kepler Space Telescope. Now, Kepler was to monitor more than 150,000 stars, watching for minute dips in brightness that would signal an exoplanet going across the face of its parent star from Earth's perspective. However, in Tabby Star, Kepler and the watchful eyes of citizen scientists involved in the Planet Hunters project found something completely different. It was observed to dim 10 times, sometimes by 1%, typical of a giant exoplanet transit, sometimes by 10 to 20%, which is not typical of all exoplanet transits or anything else for that matter, each dimming lasting days to weeks at a time. The dips were irregular both in terms of how long they were and when they occurred. There is actually a light curve on the link I sent, I put into chat. So, things got even more complicated when they discovered a longer-term behavior was discovered. It's fading away over the course of years and perhaps even centuries. Explanations for this range from the mundane star spots to the most interesting, a comet breaking up around the star, to the more science fiction inspired, a Dyson sphere siphoning the star's energy for an alien civilization. However, eventually various astronomers, including Tabitha Boyajian, Louisiana State University, and Jason Wright from Penn State, funny how that name came up earlier before we came on the air, seemed to settle on two main explanations. A circumstellar object of some sort, such as a giant comet in an elliptical orbit, or some dusty clump in the stuff between stars. Now, noticeably, the comet scenario predicts a dimming event this very month. So, from the paper published in January of 2016, a more robust prediction is that the future dimming should occur roughly every 750 days, with one in 2015 April, another in 2017 May. So, go have a look at the article, there's much more. Certain spectral fingerprints, such as those left from sodium or calcium, would also enable astronomers to learn more about the obstruction. Infrared data will also be a key, as any material close to the star ought to be hot, and therefore ought to show up as an excess infrared radiation. So, the several other astronomers, including Boyajian and Wright, have made their predictions, and they're now settled in for a wait. All they need is for the star to stop pretending to be ordinary, and sure enough, its tabby star dropped its act. So, on May at 4 a.m. on May 19th, Boyajian called Wright. Fairborn Observatory in Arizona had issued an alert that Tabby star dimmed by 3%, a big dip in the star's in the brightness. The team sent out the call for more observations. So, from the Twitter account of Ms. Boyajian's star is dipping. This is not a drill. Astro tweeps on telescopes in the next 48 hours. Spectra, please. That was at 11:24 a.m., 19th of May, 2017. So, you have been told, you have been asked, let's get the data in.
There you go. So, I guess we can kind of get close to relating Fomalhaut.
Yeah, let's go to Fomalhaut.
Yeah, we'll get some new observations of Fomalhaut with the Altacoma Large Millimeter Array and Altacoma. Well, anyways, they've got some more detail of the star and its disk of debris orbiting around it, and they found some, they've got ice crystals now. Mm-hmm. We're able to identify kind of a cloud of ice crystals around it. So,
who knows what could be going on? Maybe there's planet forming going on. Maybe there's a comet shattered mm-hmm. as it went close to the star.
Well, I think it's kind of like a Kuiper belt, you know, where there's just a bunch of comets all around it that have been kind of breaking up into different particles and colliding and combining and stuff like that too. So much more detail about Fomalhaut, and that's kind of a bright star. You can actually see it's in October from the northern hemisphere towards the south around midnight or so. So star we've been looking at all the time, and it's got stuff around it that might be forming planets.
Yeah. Have you read any good books recently, Marty?
Let's see. Just some sci-fi books, basically.
Well, I've picked up a couple of new books for the Obsy. Now, as most of you know, if I'm not looking at comets, I'm looking at the moon.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, I was doing what I usually do when I'm bored at lunch break, and I was looking, seeing what nice new books have been written about one of my favorite objects. So I found a nice oldie, Discover the Moon, and that is by Jean Lacroix and Christian Lagarde. Interestingly, these are the two people who gave us Virtual Moon Atlas. So this is a book that's described as being from the rank beginner to a well-heeled lunar buff. So I'll put a link into chat for that one. Okay, this one's second. I'm a very bad person. I buy a paperback book or a hardback textbook. Guess what? The first thing I do is I look for a link. I want this made available on Kindle or Nook. I click that link. But you know, it's worth it really because, okay, that way I have my hard copy in the observatory. And if I'm going on a trip and I have a small scope or binoculars, I have the digital version on my Kindle or Nook. And that way I can actually use my textbooks. I don't have to worry about, am I going to think about this? Do I know what this is? Have I got it wrong? No worries. I actually know what it is because I can look at my learner atlases. I can go through a formula for processing because I haven't got to worry about the book being in my observatory. I haven't got to worry about lugging the book on a plane. It's on my Kindle. My Kindle can go everywhere.
I have adapted to using taking with me a laptop to different places out observing and stuff like that. So I'll just make sure I load up the information ahead of time if it's online. So for instance, all the comment information, I'll load it. I'll basically download some of the star charts from comet positions onto my laptop. And so when I'm out in the field and I don't have, you know, internet connection, I've already got the star chart laptop on, just click on it, opens it up, and then I could use it instead of having to print out a star chart to bring with me to the field.
See, that's the nice thing about some of the trickle-down is that our laptops and tablets can go with us to the scope.
Yes.
Our laptops and tablets can run the scope. Mm-hmm. They can take control of our cameras. They can store the data for us. Okay, so maybe we got to carry an external drive. Big deal.
Yep.
But we have this lovely portable library. We have our Planetaria programs, and we have the ability to do research on the spot. Now, the other book I found was by a chap called John Moore. It's called Craters of the Near Side of the Moon. Now, the nice thing about this book is and I have put a link into chat, you can go into it, and it's got a lot of the LRO pictures, and it looks at the moon not only in quarters and quadrants, it shows you a large image of the feature, and it shows you that feature in comparison to other ones. So I've just quickly opened the look inside feature for this book, and it shows me a crater image layout. It shows me the crater appearance from an Earth perspective, an aerial view of the general region with positional points of the crater and subcraters. It gives me the latitude and longitude of the crater and of the subcraters. It gives me a description, and it gives me a close-up of the crater. So when I'm at the telescope, I have a very good idea. I could be wanting to, say, for instance, image Hadley Rill, or I want to image Tycho, or maybe Copernicus, or maybe something slightly not run-of-the-mill crater-wise. Most people know where Copernicus is, they know where Tycho is. But if you're looking for, say, something like Humboldt or something else, this gives you a very good way to find it, and it's kind of like it's like crater hopping. So you know what part of the moon you're looking at, you know what's there, you know what's around it, and you can see how the actual image would appear through your eyepiece or through the photographic image. Now, for instance, some craters may have other craters attached to it, so it gives you a quicker way to identify that image. Okay, I'm going to be honest. I would also be running Virtual Moon Atlas at the same time. And to be honest, I would probably be having that running my telescope. It has the setup to link to your telescope to guide you direct bang on to the feature you're looking for. So you could be looking for the Apennine Mountains, you could be looking for one of the real features, or you could be looking for a specific crater or craterlet, or even like looking for the crater Pico and its peak. Being able to perhaps sit back when you're not at the scope and just learn your way around in a quadrant by quadrant manner is perhaps the best way to learn the moon. It's kind of like having a star chart or a star wheel and sitting out under the night sky and learning your way around the sky. Because, yeah, GROTO scopes, they're brilliant. They are the bee's knees if you're imaging. And for some observers, they like being able to be dead on center. It's great if you're imaging a comet, if you're imaging a planet or a fuzzy, or if you're trying to do something like this, like you're trying to image a crater under various lighting conditions. Because I got news for you. That nice, bold crater that you can see at full moon, as the moon is going through its cycle, the whole optical aspect changes.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes in a way that if you're looking at a head-on image of that crater under, say, 100% illumination, you won't recognize it. So learning your way around the moon the same way you would learn around your way around the sky is perhaps a good way to enjoy it. Now, I'm a devotee of an online feature called LPOD. Now, sadly, LPOD is no longer being updated, but there are a couple of Facebook projects which set out to continue its work. This is the LPOD for today. So this is the reprint of an LPOD from August the 3rd of 2007. And it's an article by Chuck Wood. And the image is by Wes Higgins. And it's been said that a lot of people, when they actually image this particular part of the moon, and you can see the Plato rills very clearly snaking through the Imbrium Basin. Bacon. Oh, God. Bacon. We need to eat bacon. So a lot of people, they do this image of the real segment that hugs the base of the Alps Mountains on the southern edge. And they give up. They put the camera away. I've done everything I can do. But you haven't, because the moon is going to change. It's subtle. It is, and as the illumination changes, you will see different features. So saying, okay, I've done a round of the moon, is like saying, yeah, right, no, you haven't, because you may have done it under a certain condition, but you need to do it continuously year-round, because it's always going to change. You never know what you're going to see or what you might see under a different illumination. And you're going to have parts of the month where, perhaps due to weather, you just can't see it. So you need to pick up where you left off as soon as you get the moon back. And, of course, the great thing about observing the moon with a telescope is you can do it during daylight too. And then you can have even more fun because you're still imaging. Everybody's maybe switched to solar, sun, but you can still do what you want. And a lot of people image some of the gas giants that way too. You can do Jupiter during the day. It's perhaps not as fantastic as it is at night, but you can still image it, and you can manipulate the image in such a way that you get a black background instead of a blue daylight one, just to bring out more information. So saying that, oh, it's daylight, I can't do anything, I can just look at the sun, it's a total lot of rubbish. There is plenty you can do during the day as an astronomer. You don't just need to switch to your solar telescope. You can get your regular telescope out, you can perhaps mount your DSLR, and then you can go and image the moon under differing lighting conditions.
You can get the planets too.
You can get the planets too. It is all there to be done. And as I say, I keep saying, when I retire finally, if I ever do, I'm doing two things. I am going to go back to school. I am going to perhaps get my degree, get a PhD if I survive that long. And I am going to spend as much time as I can either gardening or imaging, morning, noon, evening, and afternoon, and night. 24 hours a day if I can stand the pace. That's the way to do it.
There you go. Let's give you a little rundown on what's happened with the sky and the planets and the moon and stuff like that coming up this week. Well, today is last quarter of the moon, so obviously you're going to get the earlier part of the evening a little darker than a little later. So, but that's going away. So next week after that, we get some darker stuff. So if you want to do some deep sky stuff, next week's a little bit better. Tomorrow, Neptune will be 0.5 degrees north of the moon occultation. I think I looked this one up, and the occultation was occurring in the eastern portion of Australia. So it should be that area in order to be able to see Neptune be occulted by the moon. Monday, Venus, 2 degrees north of the moon. Tuesday, Uranus, 4 degrees north of the moon. And then on Wednesday, Mercury 1.6 degrees north of the moon. Mercury's starting to fade away. We just passed greatest eastern elongation, so get your views in of Mercury the next week or so, because it's going to be start to swing around the other side of the sun, getting too close pretty soon. So it's still about 24 degrees away, but getting closer. So get your views of Mercury in. That's a good one for the daytime, too.
But as I say, we are, in some respects, we are a lucky generation. We have professional instruments. We're not paying the cost it would have been maybe 30 years ago to have a nice large aperture telescope, to have a professional imaging system. All right, I know. The average Attic or Finger Lakes imager or even SBIG, you're still talking about $3,000 or $4,000. Mm-hmm. However, that has come down from being $50,000 or $60,000 to have a electronic imager. You can go buy a DSLR. You can have the filter removed. If you do use it during regular day, you've got to put a UV in it or infrared filter on the lens itself. Otherwise, your sensor may not be very happy with you. In fact, I can guarantee it won't be.
I think you just get a color shift, don't you, basically?
No. What they've done is, what they found out is, if they pull the infrared filter on, on the Canons and Nikons, it increases the sensitivity of the actual CCD or CMOS device in the camera. Mm-hmm. But the drawback is, if you want to use it during the day for regular snapping, you've got to make sure you've got a filter on your lens. But that's nothing. They're not that expensive. I think they're about $5-$10.
Does it tend to cook the sensor, or does it just do a color shift?
It overloads the sensor, from what I understand.
I have to look that up and see.
Yeah.
If it just color shifts it. And obviously your exposure is going to change a little bit too, but only in the infrared. So if you're not looking at infrared objects, it shouldn't affect it that much.
Well, they say that it can actually affect the performance of the charge-coupled device in your camera. So if you've got any sense and you really care about your kit, you'd put a filter on your lens. But I say they're about $5 or $10. Mm-hmm. And then you just take the main lens off at night, put it back on your telescope, and you're back to astronomical imaging with it. And I think that's probably one of the greatest things is, we DSLR cameras are, what, $300 or $400 compared to a couple of grand like they used to be when they first came out.
Like $8,000 to $10,000 when they first came out.
So they have dropped in price humongously.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. A couple of things. Van Allen belts.
Yeah.
They've discovered that very long frequency radio wavelength propagation from the Earth has basically affected the magnetic fields in the Van Allen belts. There's kind of an inner barrier there. Mm-hmm. Between the outer ones, and that's because of man-made radio waves. So we can actually change the magnetic field around the Earth by changing magnetic fields on the Earth here. Isn't that something interesting?
Yeah.
We could build a force field for the Earth.
Maybe.
Using radio waves.
Be interesting to make a proposal and try and get some funding to investigate it.
Mm-hmm. Let me put the article in our chat room here. Read up further on that. Here it comes. Oh, a while ago, I didn't get a chance to mention a while ago, Cassidy offering to do the sci-fi or space kitchen there and give us free food. I was thinking of, actually, I could use some Romulan ale. Would be really nice.
Every now and again, that does come on the market. One of the breweries puts it, and I think there was someone did a Klingon blood ale or something.
Yeah, okay. That sounds good. Evidence of past heavy rain on Mars.
Hey, come on, guys. We've got to start thinking about getting all our stuff together. You know what the time is.
Oh, I know. It is. It is getting to be just about that time to get out of here. So, all right, check out the rain on Mars. We'll get to that one next week then, and a little bit more.
USS Miranda, 3 to beam up. Energize.
I don't think we're ready to get out of here just yet, but pretty close. Let's thank everybody that's been in our chat room first.
Yeah.
I appreciate you all listening in tonight, being in our chat room. So thanks for showing up tonight. Don't forget, we got more programming coming up after the Event Horizon, so stick around for more and more stuff like that. All right. So we'll head on out of here. See you guys all next weekend. Thanks for joining us tonight. Appreciate your input.
And look up. Stuff.
Yes. Time to get out of here, everybody. All right.
All right.
Good night, all. See you next time.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are Astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy. Around the world and across the known universe, this is Astronomy.fm Radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
There I was, doing my thing. And all of a sudden, wham! Astronomy right between the eyes.